another episode of the Indian Cycling Podcast. This is your co-host Gokul. In fact, we have a very special guest with us today, Michael Pride. We'll call him Mike. Is joining us from New Zealand. He's a founder of a very interesting bicycle company called Chapter 2. Introducing him is like walking through the multiple stages of a Tour de France in itself. So I will let him do the honors. Welcome to our episode, Michael. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, yeah. So it's Mike Pride here from Chapter 2 Bikes here in Auckland, New Zealand. And yeah, really happy to be able to fill you on the whole story so far with Chapter 2. So my life story really started in Hong Kong as a young child, riding mountain bikes and BMX and things like that. As a kid of the 70s, of course, you know, we used to build our own ramps and jumps and do a lot of riding. But actually, as I got a lot older, I started taking the sport quite a lot more seriously. And my first entry was actually mainly in mountain bikes. So I raced mountain bikes professionally for a short period and raced for the Hong Kong team and was actually ranked 12th in the UCI Asia in 1996. And in 1997, I was the Hong Kong downhill champion, but also did some cross country. But unfortunately, over the years, you know, with quite a few injuries and bad crashes, I actually had quite a few surgeries, about five in total. So I had my knees rebuilt, my shoulders rebuilt. And after about, you know, four or five different surgeries, I'm all fixed up. But by then I was already working a lot on my fitness to improve my mountain biking racing skills. So I moved into road cycling. So by the time I decided to retire in 1998, you know, I went to road cycling, you know, 100%. And whilst I wasn't racing professionally anymore, I was still racing at a quite a high level in Hong Kong and also around Asia. But my kind of desire and spark to be in the bicycle industry really started, you know, as a youngster, you know, with my enjoyment of design. I was did a lot of industrial design as a youngster. And then when I went to university in England, I studied architecture and was there from 1989 until 1996. And then when I returned to Hong Kong in 1996, I was actually quite fortunate that I found a very good job with a company called Foster & Partners on the Hong Kong's new airport. So I worked there for a couple of years. But then probably around 2004, you know, having worked in architecture for about 8 years, I got quite burnt out. It's a pretty tough industry, a lot of long hours, hard work. And my father, who was already in the sporting goods business, asked me to join his company, which is Neil Pride. And Neil Pride Company is probably more known for its windsurfing heritage, but also it's involved in kite surfing, but mainly in the water sports area. So, you know, with that kind of heritage and history of going into sports, I put my passion for not only design, but also sports to then within the company, Neil Pride Limited, to create the Neil Pride brand of bikes, which I ran between 2008 until 2015. So for quite a few years, we learned a lot of lessons. We developed a lot of really nice products. And when I left that company in 2015, I decided that, you know, with all those learnings and all that experience, you know, I could do a better job. And that's actually where the name Chapter 2 comes from. So Chapter 1 was really the whole Neil Pride story and the design story with architecture, you know, and then taking everything that I learned from there to create Chapter 2 as a new brand. So yeah, so in a snapshot, that's kind of how it all came about and how it all started.
Wow, that's a very... very interesting story, Michael. Glad to have you on the show. What would you describe as the purpose of Chapter 2 as a company?
The interesting thing is, you know, with Chapter 2, you know, we set out to do things a little bit differently. I think over the years, you know, being a very avid cyclist and a fan of design myself, I didn't like the idea that, you know, a brand or a purchaser was sitting there making some decisions on my behalf, such as what wheel spec to have, what tire spec to have, handlebars and things like that. So, you know, I believe truly that every bike should be very different and should be unique, and it should really be part of the personality of the consumer, the rider. So with Chapter 2, we set about creating a business model, which is a frame set only, which is a little bit against the normal trend of the big brands like Trek and Specialized who offer complete bikes. But we believe that, you know, from a very personal point of view, that actually having people select components the way they want it, the budget that they have, the time frame that they're working towards, is actually a much better solution to having a very personal experience with us and with their bikes. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's one of the areas where I think chapter two is quite different. And then secondly, we also recognized very early on, and also especially from my time at Neil Prime, was that it's very difficult to beat those big guys like Trek and Specialized and Canyon at their game of, you know, racing professionally, having a Tour de France team, because a lot of end consumers do follow what the pro riders are riding and they like to buy what the pros have. So we set about designing products which we believe are as good as those products raced at the Tour de France. But ultimately, we spent a lot of time and effort to design the frames to look really beautiful, because I think selling people on the emotional aspect of buying a Chapter 2 is just as important as selling them on the technical and the performance aspects, which is why our business is quite different from many other brands. So in each model that we have of frames, we actually have three different collections. The essential collection is always a matte and gloss black, very technical, very stealthy looking, and it sells, you know, for a number of years without any change. So generally, we try to stick to a 3 to 4 year plan. We don't change the graphics. However, with the limited editions, we launch those, you know, every 3 to 4 months, sometimes 6 months. And the idea is that they're made in very limited quantities so that somebody actually can buy something that's very exclusive and very unique to them. And on top of that, we do what we call the special editions. The special editions really are kind of a commemorative type of product. You know, we've done the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia. We recently did one called the Colors of the Peloton. And they're very, very, you know, very, very bespoke, very handmade products, which are very emotional and extremely beautiful. And, you know, we typically charge between, you know, $300 to $800 more. And we collaborate with other brands on parts and components and gifts. And those we actually only make between 15 to 20 units. And the last one that we did sold out within 2 weeks. So, yeah, very, very, it's a lot of fun, a lot of hard work, but very fulfilling at the same time.
Michael, to draw an analogy, maybe Trek and Merida are like Starbucks and you are like the Brooklyn-based handcrafted coffee made especially for connoisseurs. Is that probably?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good analogy. I think in the marketplace, you obviously got the very big brands like the Giants, the Treks and the Meridas, and they offer a lot of different product, a lot of different variation. But then at the other end of the scale, you have those very hand-built products, you know, like the Enigmas and the Fireflies and the Fescas. And those are really beautiful bikes. And, you know, I'm definitely fans of those products. But, you know, often, you know, to buy a product like that, it's quite a lengthy process. It could take up to 10 to 20 weeks. And, you know, the price is quite high. So we try to deliver to the end consumer a very personal experience, almost like a custom painted frame, you know, because it's very limited supply, but also at an affordable price. So our price range for our lowest product, the Terre, which is our best-selling product, is around $2,600 US dollars. And our most expensive bike is is a little bit over $3,000 US dollars. So I think within those boundaries of price points, you know, we have a very good offering and a very good value proposition to the end consumer, whilst people get a very, very unique product that nobody else has.
Yeah. So you also have, in fact, I have some teams riding the bikes in races as well. And we had a very interesting podium finish early this summer, right? So could you tell us about how you felt seeing one of the bikes you have designed from scratch coming and winning stuff on the podiums, being on the podiums?
Yeah, I think first of all, it's interesting note that, you know, professional cycle racing is quite an expensive sport for a frame manufacturer like us. So for the big brands like Specialized and Trek, it could run into the couple of €100,000 in cash. And on top of that, you probably have to give them between 180 to 200 bikes. So obviously, as a small startup like ours, it's actually it's out of reach. It's just an expense which is too high. So we looked at more creative ways that we could put the product, you know, under very professional, highly qualified riders, whilst being cost effective, but also positioning the brand quite differently. Because I think if you go down the Tour de France route, you know, it's all about winning, it's all about racing, it's all about the suffering. But whereas if you look at women's racing, which is growing really quickly, you know, the women out there, they're riding hard, but they have a much more kind of a fun approach to cycling. You know, they're always joking around, they're having fun. And that example that you just illustrated was actually a professional rider from the Beagler team called Cecily. you know, where she came third at the recent Tour of Flanders. And, you know, and her after-race interview was just one of the most animated interviews that you'll ever see in professional cycling. And I think that sense of fun that she brings to the team and to the brand is really positions us very well, because we want to be seen as a brand that does have fun, likes to take a little bit of risk on graphic design and on the aesthetics, you know, and to go with it, you know, in a very unique way.
Awesome. Yeah. In fact, last week I was just staying in front of the center of Tour of Flanders. So yeah, it's a great place to race as well. So, I ride the Terre, which you were talking about, which is a fantastic all-round racing bike, which is good for climbing, descending, and racing in any circumstances. Could you walk us through what are the other models that Chapter 2 has right now, Mike?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, when we started the design project for what Chapter 2 was going to be, we wanted a bike that was very inclusive. It was something that you could buy and do just about anything with it. And, you know, I've been in cycling for many, many years, and I still look at the old historic frames like, you know, from Colnago and, you know, the more history frames like Eddie Merckx, and they typically have a horizontal top tube. Mm. And when I started the design project for the Terre, it was really about looking at some of those more historic silhouettes that you see from the frame design, and to design something which had a classic look. So the Terre has a horizontal top tube. But then what we did after that was we actually went back and applied a lot of very modern technology. Obviously, it's made out of carbon fiber, which is 100% Toray. And we also put the frame through a quite an extensive kind of aerodynamic design process. And we had those frames tested in the Auckland University wind tunnel, the same place that does a lot of the development work for the America's Cup. So there's a lot of expertise there and a lot of design features and technical features, which is designing the frame to be not only performance driven, but also to have this kind of more classic aesthetic. And then, you know, after we had designed and started producing the Terre, we actually already were very well advanced with the second bike, which is the Rare. And the Rare means, you know, flow, so like airflow in the local Maori language here. And the idea of the aero bike is obviously, you know, to be as aerodynamic as possible. And we design the frame, again, with a lot of aerodynamic features. Unlike a lot of other brands who have gone towards more camtail design, we've actually gone for a much more pure aero shape. And the logic and rationale behind that is that, you know, it's not a sprinter's frame. So the stiffness, whilst it's comparable to the Terre, is not the most critical aspect of the frame. So aerodynamics, speed through the wind, is definitely critical. So you see from the tube profiles on the fork and the down tube, they aren't camtail like you see on the Scott Foyle and some of the other brands like Trek, Madone, etc. So it's very much a kind of aero-inspired type of design. And on top of that, we recognize that, you know, people often want to have one bike and not have to, you know, buy another time trial bike or another triathlon bike. So when we designed it with a seat post that can be reversed. So in the standard, you know, slightly laid back position or 15 millimeter setback, you can actually rotate that seat post and move it forward to 35 millimeters. And with that more forward stance, you can actually get into a much more TT position. And we actually have quite a lot of customers who have bought the Rare and built it up completely as their TT bike, you know, with an aero cockpit from, you know, Envy or Profile Design or some of these other manufacturers. So it's a very, very fast bike through the wind. But then, of course, you know, when it comes to climbing, we felt as though there was an opportunity to design something really special and really engineered. And just as we were starting to deliver the Rares into the market in May 2018, we were already quite well advanced on the Huru, which is our climbing bike. And then, you know, we launched that last November in Japan. And it's a super fast climbing bike and pretty stable and stiff on the descents as well. Yeah, so at the moment, those are the three bikes that we have. And actually in a few months time, around September, October time, we're also going to be launching a gravel bike. So we're super excited about that because, you know, we see a lot of opportunity for this more kind of off the beaten track type of cycling, which a lot of people are doing these days.
Mm. Yeah, in fact, I think I am personally very excited to have the gravel bike come in because I feel that is a segment which will appeal to a larger audience in India because we have a lot of people who are not who are looking into more endurance riding through at times a more difficult terrain, and a bike which can't handle anything, and it is at the same time, you know, top of the line. So
yeah, I remember when I came to visit you quite a few months ago, I spent a bit of time in Mumbai, Bangalore, Chennai, and, you know, had a good look around and talked to a lot of people, obviously to try and learn as much as I could about, you know, the market in India. And it seems like the Audax type of riding and racing is very popular in India. And yeah. I think with the gravel bike, which is called the AO, which is Earth in Maori, I think we have a really good product that could really appeal to that market, because it's a little bit more comfortable, it's a little laid back, less aggressive, and allows you a huge variety of choices of tires, because you can fit a 700C wheel on there with a 42 millimeter tire, or you can put a 650B wheel on there and put a 47 millimeter tire. So you actually have a lot of range and breadth in terms of tire clearance and tire choice. You know, and people can actually change their tires depending on how they're going to ride. If they're going to be slightly more off-road or more road or more bumpy, you know, with air pressure and tire width, you can really custom and tailor that ride quality that you want.
So, Michael, let me be a total newbie, and maybe you can tell me why someone like me would need a gravel bike. So my general idea of riding longer distances is always have good tires. You know, as yes. long as you have good tires, you have a decent chain and all that, you're good. I never really think about the frame. Can you tell me why a frame is important in that kind of scenario?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things you have to consider, because I think, you know, this idea that there's one bike that can do everything well, in my opinion, is a myth. Because I think when you try and design a product like that, there's always going to be a compromise. Because an aero bike, you know, is not going to climb as well as our climbing bike, you know, and our Terre all-round bike is not going to be as aerodynamic as our Rare. So there's always a bit of a compromise. So, you know, when you look at the gravel category, the interesting thing, the gravel is kind of spurned from this idea that, you know, people are a little bit jaded by all the racing and all the toughness of what mountain of road cycling is all about. And road cycling as a sport almost takes itself too seriously. So we've seen this kind of splintering off of the demographic of people who rode for many, many years and maybe did a lot of racing. But now they've got to that age in their life, or their time in their life, where they're actually looking to have more fun, you know, going a little bit off-road whilst doing some road. So typically, you know, people mostly live in cities, you know, people who buy products like ours. So they live in the city, but they want to be able to ride from the city, from their home, on roads to an area which is more mountainous, you know, and then the where there's gravel roads and dirt roads. However, if you rode a pure road bike and you wanted to do that, you get to the edge of the where the road meets the dirt, and then you have a bike that doesn't perform so well on the dirt because the tires are slipping around. There's a much better chance of getting a snake bite type of puncture and things like that. And if you chose to ride a mountain bike instead, you know, the idea is that you're a mountain bike, you're riding from your home to where the gravel road starts. You know, the road tires are so wide and thick that they're just not that efficient on the road. However, in my opinion, if you put a set of, you know, 30 to 35 millimeter tires, it's going to perform close to how a road bike performs. But then when you get to the gravel section, you can still ride on the gravel and do a little bit of, you know, off-piste type of riding. So I think it's, you know, the gravel sector is quite an interesting genre. And in some countries where, you know, the road quality actually isn't that good to start with, having that gravel bike option and having slightly wider tires actually allows you to ride with more fun and more comfort. You know, like in New Zealand, the roads are generally not sealed here. They can be quite rough. So, you know, gravel bike actually offers you a lot of opportunity to do a lot of different things. But from a technical point of view, I think one of the major kind of technical differences between a more typical road bike and a gravel bike, it really is the tire clearance. So, you know, with all the different bottom bracket standards and the actual width of the bottom bracket, there's actually so much that you can do to fit the tire in between, because, you know, the industry standards are pretty much set by Shimano, who define how wide the bottom bracket is, the chain line and things like that. So you can't actually get much more than a 30 millimeter tire in a road bike. So by using a drop chainstay you know, which is what we do on the drive side, you actually can provide a much more tire clearance. And, you know, as such, then you can put much wider tires. So there's technical reasons why, you know, the frame is designed in such a way. But at the end of the day, I think this genre that we're going into with this gravel bike is definitely a new area that people are starting to explore. And there's also now a lot of races like Dirty Kanza, there's Granduro. Actually, they have Granduro in Japan for the first time this year as well. So there's an entire new category of much more kind of open-minded, free-thinking people who just want to enjoy their bikes and get a little dirty at the same time.
Yeah, and very interestingly, Mike, my personal experience in India has been that whenever a road is in the process of either getting constructed or getting damaged, that is when the road has much lesser traffic and is more pleasure for a rider to ride in. The moment the road gets completely done and, you know, fully tarmac and all the lanes and stuff, that is when the road gets dominated by all the motor traffic, motor vehicles. So while all cyclists in India do complain about the road quality, the reality is the moment the road gets good enough, we are just going to be knocked off by the motorcyclists, and it's no longer going to be a pleasure riding those. So having a bike which can handle the road conditions, which are at times patchy, is very important, because that allows us to have the pleasure of riding in peace.
Cycling in different markets in different countries is going through different kind of levels of development. So I think in terms of road cycling, you know, it's a relatively new thing in India, you know, and people's skill levels are different. You know, in Europe, people buy a bike and the first thing they do is they jump onto very narrow tires. But I think sometimes as a first time buyer, you know, in a relatively new market like in India, the idea of having slightly fatter tires and maybe not even clip in pedals, even flat pedals or mountain bike pedals, gives people a lot more kind of confidence to build their skill sets to a level where they may want to move into road bikes in the future. So I think, you know, the gravel bike is an interesting segment in its own. And I think in different countries, it will be interpreted in different ways. So yeah, we're excited to see how the AO will be received in India.
Do you see any other trend emerging in a few years in terms of the road bike segment? Right now, the last 4 years has been kind of dominated by the emergence of the gravel bike. Do you see, when do you see this ending, and what do you think could be a next wave, if you can be Nostradamus?
Yeah. yeah, if I could see the future, I'd probably be making a lot more money. But I think if we take a step back, I think one of the biggest changes in cycling in recent years is obviously the disc brake. And I remember my years of racing mountain bikes. You know, I raced on just caliper brakes, you know, cantilever brakes for many, many years. And as I was, you know, coming to the end of my racing career, it was just at the introduction of the disc brake and also full suspension bikes. But you look at now the quality of the disc brakes that are available, you know, and the arguments or the pros and the cons, it's really difficult to see how the rim brake as a category will actually survive. I mean, a lot of people debate, you know, very, very aggressively at times about the pros and the cons of disc versus rim. But at the end of the day, you know, better brakes is just better brakes. So why would you not choose better brakes? It's a safety feature. It's a performance feature. Your braking distances are far shorter because you have better braking. So, you know, this argument of I don't need rim brakes for me is an argument that's just wrong. I think the quicker we can move towards everybody having discs, the easier it is for manufacturers like us to design bikes and to produce bikes and to have, you know, the right quality of stock in the inventory so that we can sell it. Because at the moment it's doubled because we actually have to keep rim and disc. But now that the UCI have fully adopted and accepted disc brakes, you know, we feel that this transition is going to happen a lot quicker, and we're actually already seeing it, because not only about 5 or 6 months ago, a lot of our Asian markets didn't really want to talk about disc brakes, but now, you know, they're definitely talking about it and they want it. But in some countries, like in Korea, where disc brakes are coming not allowed in racing, you know, there's always going to be those hurdles. However, in January the 1st, 2020, that's all going to change. So in Korea, we're going to see a big switch towards disc. So I think, you know, that transition from, you know, rim brake to disc brake is happening now and is going to continue to accelerate. And I believe that within the next 2 to 3 years, you know, rim brake would be gone and finished, and we'll all be on disc brakes, and there'll be a lot more investment in terms of design engineering in disc brakes, because I think there's still a lot of room to improve in terms of designing disc brakes, which are maybe anti-squeaking, more adjustability in terms of, you know, the amount of reach you have in the lever, the distances between the pad and the disc. So that's what I think one of the areas that I'm seeing right now is happening in the market. And then the second thing that is changing a lot is this idea of integration. You know, the idea of putting all the cable, either all the hydraulic hoses, all the electric wires internally. And, you know, this is definitely something that we're looking at closely and something that we may offer in the near future. But, you know, these projects can be quite long for us as a small company. So, you know, we keep an eye on it and we see how those trends develop. But for sure, you know, having fully integrated cockpits while still allowing the consumer for good bike fitting options, stem lengths, handlebar widths is an important consideration. So that's, I think, the second thing that's changing. And then another area that we're seeing other bigger manufacturers go into is this idea of having more comfort. And you see from the Specialized, the Roubaix with their suspension, with the Madones with their ISO speeds, there's definitely a lot of work and engineering that's gone into those products. And they're pretty amazing products. There's a lot of high performance. But at the same time, I wonder if the bike has become a little bit more complicated than it needs to be. Because, you know, for most people, you can probably, you know, get similar comfort levels by just taking 10 or 15 PSI out of their tires, or going from a, you know, 22 or 23 millimeter tire up to a 28 millimeter tire. So actually tire width and tire pressure actually has a lot of things to do with how the quality of the ride is and the performance and the comfort. So when people come to us and say, listen, you know, I've been riding your bike with some friends and the bike feels a little bit stiff and hard, and we ask them what tire pressure they put in, they're saying, no, 110 or 120 PSI. Well, you know, that's kind of yesterday's kind of story. In this modern age, everybody's only running between, you know, 80 to 90 PSI and with wider tires, and you get a much better quality ride, much better traction, and the rolling resistance is even less. So yeah, there's a lot of variables, which is one of the reasons why we believe that offering a frame set alone is actually the better option, because then the end consumer, based on where they live, how they ride, the type of quality they ride, you know, they can spec the tires and the wheels exactly the way they want. And those, you know, the frame and the wheels and the tires are probably the three things that have the biggest variable on the performance of a bike.
Interesting.
Yeah. Michael, what was the technical aspect of bike riding? So on the business side, there have been attempts to bring in new models. I know of SpeedX, which tried a Kickstarter model. Of course, it had its own problems, and that's a totally different story. But yeah. Would you do something like that? Maybe try a crowdfunded campaign for a particular bike in the future?
Yeah, I think that the SpeedX example is quite an interesting one, because I think the problem that they had is that they couldn't really make up their mind whether they were a technology company or whether they were a bike company, because, you know, they were trying to design a GPS built into the stem of a bike. You know, so suddenly you're in that area of technology and developing apps, developing software, and that's a whole different business to bicycle design. And they were trying to do both at the same time with their first bike. And I think at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of good competition out there for GPS units like Garmin and Wahoo. You know, unless they're fully invested in making those continuous improvements to those GPS units, then if you buy something like that and there's no software update, there's no maps, all those other functionalities that you expect from a good quality GPS, then that product fails on its own. And then when you're trying to integrate, you know, a GPS unit into a stem with a built-in lithium-ion battery, the whole unit becomes quite heavy. Whilst I don't know the ins and the outs and details of why they failed, that what I have read from the press, at least, was that the ride quality at the end of the day didn't match the market expectation. And I think you can design all the technology that you want, but if the ride quality is poor, it doesn't really mean much. So we focus on ride quality, And if people want to buy GPSs and things like that, you know, they're free to buy it from all these other brands, which make very good products. And then coming back to your point regarding Kickstarter, the problem with Kickstarter is that I think as a startup, it's actually quite a good vehicle to obviously raise capital in order to open the mold and the tools that you need to produce a certain amount of product. So the way I see it is that, you know, if you had an idea and a concept for a unique product, but you didn't have the capital to find a supplier in a particular country, or to open the molds and the tools that you need, because they're quite a big investment, then you want to pre-sell something based on a promise, you know, and then get the cash in so that you can start delivering product. And effectively, those early adopters are investing, paying for those molds in order for you to produce the product. However, the problem that I have with that business model is that often to get buy-in from those early adopters, you have to reduce your retail price significantly to a level where it's not sustainable as a business. So once the raise is all done and you've produced the first batch, you come back to raising your prices back to a realistic level that you can continue to invest in the brand and the product and distribution, then nobody buys it because they bought the first lot because of the price. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. So for sure, it was something that we looked at. But when I looked at the landscape of what actually happens on Kickstarter and the sentiment that people have of why they purchase certain products on there, we didn't see it as a long-term sustainable business model, mainly for the reasons that you can't raise the retail price back to a sustainable level that's healthy for the consumer and for the brand.
It's very interesting how we did not cover how me and Michael got together. It was December, I think. I was touring in Thailand when I got a email from Michael about coming and visiting us, and I had put a vacation message to contact Sampath in my absence, and Michael had contacted me and Sampath, and he very quickly came down to India, actually. He was one of those, not one of those, he was the only founder of a company like this who was keen and to come directly and see the market and ride here. And he actually got his own bike. And interestingly, he and Chitty are of the same height. So Chitty had the pleasure of riding his bike. And when he took his bike for a ride, he took a while to come back. So we were thinking he probably ran away with the bike. And he said that he was tempted to do that because it was such an awesome bike. And Chitty very clearly said that it was the best bike that he had ever ridden. Of course, Mike had built the bike on some of the best quality wheels and drivetrain and so on. But it was such a good experience that Chitty couldn't stop talking about that bike for a while. And
that sounds good.
So I think that feedback, because finally, like you said about SpeedX, like whatever are our intentions, finally the right quality is the ultimate ultimate answer to your question whether you want to ride or buy a bike. So we are very clear that this is something which is we would be interested in being part of, and you know, we had the pleasure of having somebody at his level come down to us, be riding with us. So he spent 3 days with us riding and talking, exploring the market. And we also had our own doubts, because when the average price of a complete bike that we sell is around 50,000 rupees, to sell a frame which is 1.5 to 2 lakh Indian rupees is not a joke. And it took a lot of convincing for us ourselves. But the convincing became much easier when we rode the bike. And then I picked up one of the first Chapter 2 bikes or frames myself. I built mine around the Terre. And then Akash was looking for a bike, and we built a Rere around that. And then that's how Bike Affair started getting involved with Chapter 2, and we are eagerly waiting, like I said, for the AO to come in, and I think that is when we will see a significant more number of Chapter 2 bikes on India.
Yeah, I think, you know, to add to that, I think, you know, there's no other way to understand the market than to just go there and talk to the people. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you can do all the research that you can on the internet and try and find out where the bicycle shops are, you know, what type of brands are in the market and things like that. But, you know, when you sit down with somebody like yourself, you know, who owns a bike shop, who created a bike shop, you start to help to work together to understand what the problems are. You know, what problem are we trying to solve here? Is it purely a pricing problem? Or is it availability? Or is it information? So by coming to the market, and I spent, you know, about 2.5-3 weeks in India, you know, having traveled to 4 different cities, you know, I got to understand in a lot more detail how the market works. At the end of the day, you know, our manufacturing price from our factory is a certain amount of dollars, and we can't sell it for a very low price. So that's kind of, you know, just the realities of business. But at the end of the day, you know, we're not, as a brand, we're not trying to be everything to everybody. And I think when I look at, you know, the landscape in India, you definitely have a fast growing middle class who not only have, you know, the income to start to enjoy life, but also they're looking for experience. So whether it's traveling, whether it's kayaking, mountain biking, or just, you know, going out to see the world, they're looking for things to experience. And I think cycling actually does allow you this opportunity. And, you know, our ambassador in India, Bikey Venki, is actually riding in India, in Italy at the moment. Mm-hmm. So when I see, you know, so many of these Indian cyclists racing at the Tour of Friendship in Thailand, traveling to Italy and things like that, it's incredibly encouraging where the market is going in India. And I think with this growing middle class, you know, and us looking at products like the AO, which would suit the Indian market, you know, we see a lot of opportunity for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, very interestingly, later in August, Mike, we are having more than 300 people from India going for the PVP.
Wow. Okay. That's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. I mean, I think totally in the past, we might have had less than 20, 30 people going from India. And this year, we have 300. So it's a significantly big jump.
That's great. Who's organizing that?
Yeah, PVP is the marquee event of ODAX, which happens once in 4 years. So, yeah. So any randonneur is looking forward to it, or it's probably the ultimate mecca. It is the equivalent of Boston Marathon to cyclists or endurance cyclists. So the ultimate event that anybody would want to compete as part of their endurance cycling career. So yeah,
that sounds amazing. Maybe I should come and turn up as well and ride with you guys.
Yeah, I mean, and you will be spending a lot of time doing that because it's a 1200 kilometer ride. So
okay.
So that was a great experience about Chapter 2. So before we conclude today's episode, I thought I will pick your brains on the latest Tour de France, which concluded a couple of days ago, Michael. It was, for me personally, it was very, very heartening to see how hard and well Julian Alaphilippe caught on and fought to retain that yellow jersey. And while everybody seemed to be indicating that the incident on the 19th stage, wherein they had to prematurely close the stage for the first time because of the landslide, and he lost his yellow jersey on that day, and probably the tour. While that seemed you know, more or less predestined thing to happen, I did feel that it was still very very unfair to Julian Alaphilippe and others, and it turned out to be a great Tour de France, one of the most exciting ones, while still Team Ineos managed to produce its fourth Tour de France winner. So What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Yeah, actually, because of the time zone here in New Zealand, I actually don't get to watch as much of the tour as I'd like to, because it's early morning, about 3 or 4 o'clock when they're showing the tour. Okay. So I've been obviously following it, you know, through the highlights and through online and things like that. But, you know, I am an avid cyclist, so I do follow it very carefully. And I think my view is that, you know, what Julian Alaphilippe did was pretty amazing. You know, for a guy who is known for the classics, to be able to not only wear the yellow jersey, but to actually, you know, be able to stay with the climbers in some of those big stages is incredible. But I think ultimately, you know, the Tour de France is about creating spectacle, about creating stories. And what you find in most tours is that the last couple of days before they go to Paris is always stacked with big mountains and big hills. Mm-hmm. And I think whether that stage was cut short or not, ultimately, I think he would have lost the yellow. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that doesn't take away the fact that he fought hard and fought well. And, you know, of course, it's always a beautiful romantic story to have a Frenchman win the Tour de France, because it's been a long time since they did. I think Eno was the last one that won the tour for the French. So, you know, not only did they have Julien Alaphilippe, but they also have the Pino as well. But sadly, Pino had to step off because of torn thigh muscle. So, you know, I totally agree that, you know, this tour was probably the most open one. And if you look at a stage by stage, how the Ineos riders were progressing, they were always in the hunt. They were always thereabouts, always close. It was a case of just who was going to step up, you know, and that stage when that was cut short, you know, Egan Bernal was ready up the road. In fact, if they had finished the whole stage, there's probably a good chance that the time differences would have even been bigger. So, you know, at the end of the day, we'll never know, because, you know, that's in history now. But I think ultimately, I think the pure climbers and the guys who can time trial well are always going to win the Tour de France. Historically, that's always been the case. And I don't see that changing, especially when you have a team that's as strong as Ineos that can have any number of riders that could be up at the GC. And of course, next year, they've got Chris Froome coming back as well. So, yeah, it should be interesting to watch for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting you said that, because Julien Alaphilippe again surprised everyone by winning that lone individual time trial as well. So with people who are known for time trials like Geraint Thomas around, and Alaphilippe beat everybody to the podium that day. So it is
pretty amazing. I think it was a relatively short time trial, and it was rolling with some hills. I think the final finish was actually on a climb. Yeah. So, and I think the climb wasn't necessarily long, so the time differences were relatively small. Mm. But yeah, for sure. I mean, for a guy who actually won a lot of races this season already, to wear the yellow for as long as he did is just incredible. Mm. And I'm obviously sad to see, but I think ultimately in a sport which is very hard and very calculated, you know, the winner always comes through at the end, you know, whether it's a team or an individual. So you see in the case this year, at the end of the day, Ineos had a lot of talent stacked up and ready to go. And if it wasn't Thomas, it would have been Bernal. Mm. So, yeah.
So, thank you, Michael, for your time. It was an awesome interview. I always find it very exciting to talk to you because you seem to give me very different and very unique perspectives, whether it is about racing, about designing bikes, or even about the ideas and thought process behind a business model. So as usual, I'm always finishing a talk with you much more enriched. Thank you. And in fact, you are the first person in our podcast purely from the bicycling industry. We have till now had more riders and racers come in as guests. You are the only person who has come in from the industry. So it's a pleasure, and thank you for your time.
No, the pleasure is mine. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the support. And, you know, we're really hoping that, you know, we can build a much bigger presence in India and working with our various different dealers and partners there, and to do something special. And from a personal level, you know, I'd like to come back very soon and do some riding with you guys.
Sure, we will. I am also looking forward to that.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.